His involvement with gambling was limited to a weekend junket to Atlantic City with two other law professors, both of whom had read a book on successful crap shooting and were convinced they could beat the house. They did not. Ray had rarely played cards. He found a home at the $5 blackjack table, and after two miserable days in a noisy dungeon, he cleared $60 and vowed not to return. His colleagues' losses were never nailed down, but he learned that those who gamble quite often lie about their success. For a Monday night, there was a respectable crowd at the Santa Fe Club, a hastily built box the size of a football field. A 10-floor tower attached to it housed the guests, mostly retirees from up north who had never dreamed of setting foot in Mississippi, but were now lured by unlimited slots and free gin while they gambled. In his pocket, he had five bills taken from five different sections of the loot he had counted in the motel room. He walked to an empty blackjack table where the dealer was half asleep and placed the first bill on the table. "Play it," he said. "Playing 100, the dealer said over her shoulder, where no one was there to hear it. She picked up the bill, rubbed it with little interest, then put it in play. "It must be real," he thought, and relaxed a little. "She sees them all day long." She shuffled one deck, dealt the cards, promptly hit 24, then took the bill from Judge Attlee's buried treasure and put down two black chips. Ray played them both, $200 a bet, nerves of steel. She dealt the cards quickly, and with 15 showing, she hit a 9. Ray now had four black chips. In less than a minute, he had won $300. Rattling the four black chips in his pocket, he strolled through the casino, first through the slots where the crowd was older and subdued, almost brain dead as they sat on their stools, pulling the arm down again and again, staring sadly at the screens. At the craps table, the dice were hot and a rowdy bunch of rednecks were hollering instructions that made no sense to him. He watched for a moment, completely bewildered by the dice and the bets and the chips changing hands. At another empty blackjack table, he tossed down the second $100 bill, more like a seasoned gambler now. The dealer pulled it close to his face, held it up to the lights, rubbed it, and took it a few steps over to the pit boss, who was immediately distrustful of it. The pit boss produced a magnifying device that he stuck in his left eye and examined the bill like a surgeon. Just as Ray was about to break and bolt through the crowd, he heard one of them say, "It's good." He wasn't sure which one said it because he was looking wildly around the casino for armed guards. The dealer returned to the table and placed the suspicious money in front of Ray, who said, "Play it." Seconds later, the Queen of Hearts and the King of Spades were staring at Ray, and he had won his third hand in a row. Since the dealer was wide awake and his supervisor had done a close inspection, Ray decided to settle the matter once and for all. He pulled the other three $100 bills from his pocket and laid them on the table. The dealer inspected each carefully, then shrugged and said, "You won't change?" "No, play them." "Playing 300 cash," the dealer said loudly, and the pit boss loomed over his shoulder. Ray stood on a 10 and a 6. The dealer hit on a 10 and a 4, and when he turned over the jack of diamonds, Ray won his fourth straight hand. The cash disappeared and was replaced with six black chips. Ray now had 10, $1,000, and he also had the knowledge that the other 30,000 bills stuffed into the back of his car were not counterfeit. He left one chip for the dealer and went to find a beer. The sports bar was elevated a few feet, so that if you wanted, you could have a drink and take in all the action on the floor. Or you could watch pro baseball, or NASCAR reruns, or bowling on any of the dozen screens. But you couldn't gamble on the games. It wasn't allowed yet. He was aware of the risks the casino posed. Now that the money was real, the next question was whether it was marked in some way. The suspicions of the second dealer and his supervisor would probably be enough to get the bills examined by the boys upstairs. They had Ray on video, he was certain, same as everybody else. Casino surveillance was extensive. He knew that from his two bright pals who'd planned to break the bank at the craps table. If the money set off alarms, they could easily find him, couldn't they? But where else could he get the money examined? Walk in the First National in Clanton and hand the teller a few of the bills? Mind taking a look at these, Miss Dempsey? See if they're real or not? No teller in Clanton had ever seen counterfeit money, and by lunch the entire town would know that Judge Attlee's boy was sneaking around with a pocket full of suspicious money. He had thought of waiting until he was back in Virginia. He would go to his lawyer, who could find an expert to examine a sample of the money, all nice and confidential. But he couldn't wait that long. If the money was fake, he'd burn it. Otherwise, he wasn't sure what to do with it. He drank his beer slowly, giving them time to send down a couple of goons in dark suits who would walk up and say, "Got a minute?" They couldn't work that fast, and Ray knew it. If the money was marked, it would take days to link it to wherever it came from. Suppose he got caught with marked money. What was his crime? He had taken it from his deceased father's house, a place that had been willed to him and his brother. He was the executor of the estate, soon to be charged with the responsibility of protecting its assets. He had months to report it to both the probate court and the tax authorities. If the judge had somehow accumulated the money by illegal means, then sorry, he's dead now. Ray had done nothing wrong, at least for the moment.